The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center, Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the monthly guest Dharma series.
So, I've come here today from Massachusetts, on my way through to Iowa, actually. But I've come today to talk with you about integrity. And I mention this subject because I think it's something that's sometimes undervalued in the Buddhist tradition. And I think that it's something that is often viewed as a means towards an end rather than as a practice in itself. And so I want to try to make a case today, drawing upon classical sources, to really valorate and bring some added enthusiasm to the practice of sila. The words I'm referring to here, I'll be using this threefold model that most of you are probably familiar with in Buddhist thought. They really see the Dharma as the teachings of the Buddha as organizing into three broad categories. The first is sila, the second samadhi, and the third punya. Now, sila is a word that's usually translated as morality, or sometimes as virtue. And I really don't prefer those words to translate sila, because I think they come with a certain amount of baggage from the Western tradition that's not necessarily helpful. Morality often brings the sense of right and wrong, of good and bad, of someone behaving properly or behaving badly, and often needing reward and punishment, and that whole dynamic, which is really what a lot of Western religious morality and secular legal law is built upon. The trouble with virtue is that it got a lot of Greekness to it, a lot of this sense of aspiring to some ideal, of trying to rise up to become a virtuous person, like the Greek philosophers often spoke about ethics. I like the word integrity because it really suggests, and I think this is much closer to the original, the sense of sila as an expression of the quality of one's mind, an expression of how one of one's level of understanding, I would even say. Integrity is a word that suggests the quality of a person's character. We say if somebody has integrity, then you know that there's some strength there, there's some goodness, there's some beauty. And I think really that's what the Buddhists are talking about. Sila, as a category, has to do with behavior. And this is where it's interfacing these days with psychology. Most of psychology has to do with understanding and helping develop human behavior in various ways. And Buddhism was very much involved with this also from the very beginning. So integrity as an expression through one's behavior of one's quality of mind and one's understanding. The second component of this system, sila, and then the next one, samadhi, literally means concentration, but it generally refers to the entire range of meditative arts, of meditative skills, the whole enterprise of developing the mind, of training the mind, of using various technologies of awareness, technologies of attentiveness, practices of bringing the mind to a single point, practices of turning the mind to the inward dimension of experience, bringing mindfulness to bear on body, feelings, mind, and mental objects. And so broadly means mental training of one sort or another. And then this third component, the punya, translates as wisdom, or perhaps we can also call it understanding, and it's often used as a translation. Now, we're used to thinking of these three. If you go to an early textbook on Buddhism, you'll see a sort of triangle, and at the bottom is, you know, morality, and in the middle is meditation, and at the top is wisdom or understanding. And there's this whole view that's developed that rightly or wrongly, both in the West and in Asia, that somehow the first tier of this system, the practices of moral integrity or virtue, are something that are somehow more pedestrian than the other two. That maybe lay people, simple villagers, practice morality, where, you know, the monks or the professionals do the meditation. And then of all those people that do the meditation, maybe only a small percentage of them actually have this arhatship, this attainment, this awakening of nirvana. And so you get this sense of it being, you know, more and more esoteric as you go along. We get this idea partly from habits of Western thought and partly from the way it's expressed in the classical literature of Buddhism. In the classical literature, we often hear about the Buddha training monks. A lot of what was going on in ancient India was the Buddha assembling this community of professional practitioners whose job it was to aspire and work towards, in this very lifetime, the radical enlightenment of the mind, the radical waking up from delusions. And he used various metaphors. It's like training a horse, or it's like training an elephant. You know, there's this wonderful sutta called the Elephant Training Sutta. They say, well, if you want to tame a wild elephant, you've got to, you know, entice it out of the forest, and you've got to, you know, stake it to the ground, and you've got to be kind to it and give it certain things to eat and abstain from letting it have certain other things until it gets used to you, and then there's various ways that you take the training further and further, and then ultimately you have this magnificently trained animal. Well, he uses that as a metaphor for training the monks and nuns for this professional aspiration of awakening the mind. You know, he said you have to, a monk begins by withdrawing from the matrix of human relationships, of duties, professional duties and so forth, wandering forth into the homeless life, and that the first part of the training for monks is for them to perfect their integrity, perfect their sila, become better and better at telling the truth, of not harming creatures, of not taking what's not been given, and so forth. And then when they are well established in healthy lifestyle and a healthy character and so forth, then you introduce the practice of meditation. There's various stages of meditation, of course, from mindfulness at one end through jhana, or, you know, higher absorption practices, to the attainment of special powers and abilities and so forth. And then if all goes well, that blossoms, like the lotus coming out of the water and blossoming above it, into this sort of opening of the mind to the radical impermanence and selflessness and so forth of reality. And so when we hear that, especially from our Western training, we're used to thinking of things hierarchically. We're used to thinking that things at the bottom of any pile is worse off than anything that's at the top of the pile. Anytime we see a vertical image, we have the sense that we need to get to the top of it, you know, to succeed, to master the system. And so there's been an emphasis upon this integrity portion of the teaching that it's somehow a pedestrian practice. You know, it's something that, you know, householders do to try to get by in the world. But where the real action is in meditation. And meditation is something that we go to a special meditation center, or we take an hour out of our day, or a week out of our month, or a month out of our year, or whatever, go to a very protected environment and focus entirely on the highly disciplined training of the mind in very attenuated circumstances, thereby breaking through into various levels of non-ordinary experience. And that, you know, it's only through that practice of meditation that we have access to some of the insights that the Buddhist tradition has to offer us. And so historically, as this great movement that we're part of watching the Buddhist tradition become established in the West, in centers like this and elsewhere, really the emphasis is largely upon meditation. But what I'd like to suggest is that this integrity is actually at the heart of the path, is at the heart of the whole tradition. And it was never considered to be either entirely preparatory or something of lesser value. From the very beginning, this three-part system of integrity, mental training, and understanding were all meant to be understood as part of the same system. No one stage is more important than the other, because in fact, all three stages fully depend upon one another. They are interdependent, and one cannot develop without the other. In particular, for a moment at least, I want to try to imagine or place emphasis upon the relationship between integrity on the one hand and wisdom on the other. Let's bypass the meditation piece for a moment and just recognize that when it comes to the actual manifestation of integrity in our lives, it's always going to be a reflection of how much we understand. Integrity is merely, or action, behavior in the world, is merely the external component of who we are as a person, what we understand, and how wise we are. Basically, if we understand the harm that's caused by hurting others, if we understand the harm that we do to ourselves and others through lying or stealing or misbehaving sexually or financially or any of those ways, then we'll refrain from doing them. A lot of times we misbehave either because we don't understand the harm that we're doing to others or to ourselves, or because we can't overcome the compulsion to do that harm, even though we know it's doing harm. And so our ability as lay people living in the ordinary world to behave well, to learn how to be a better person, is ultimately going to hinge upon how well we understand the nature of ourselves and the world we live in. And that's what these higher reaches of the practice, in my mind, are there to help us do. That we really have to see all three as an integrated whole. And I think generally when we can recognize in people who have done a lot of the practice, who have understood a lot of the teachings, we can see that reflected in their behavior. I, for one, am not a big fan of that interpretation that people can be very highly evolved spiritually, but very underdeveloped psychologically. And therefore, we have great teachers that are misbehaving in some very primitive and unwholesome ways. In the earliest phase of the tradition, one of the first sort of questions that they faced historically was a situation where someone who was considered very highly evolved, actually considered an arhat, an awakened being, gets caught in some misbehavior. They don't specify the misbehavior in the text, but it seems to be sexual misbehavior. And then a debate comes up. Well, how is this possible? How is it somebody who has overcome the forces of craving can nevertheless succumb to the compulsion to gratify those cravings? And there were two camps, and the progressives were saying, well, the person was awakened, but then they backslided somehow, and they lost that awakening, and so they misbehaved. But the conservatives circled the wagons and said, basically, if this person is misbehaved, it's proof positive that they weren't awakened, that they just did not have the higher level of realization that everybody attributed to them. And therefore, it is the case that if somebody is evolved in their wisdom, it will always be reflected in their behavior. And so right from the beginning, they saw this very important link between these two. Now, I don't mean to undervalue the role of meditation, and as we're going to see, it plays a big role in both the practice of integrity and of wisdom. But since we're used to giving it so much attention, often to the exclusion of the others. I want to try to emphasize that piece today. Now, in the basic teachings of integrity, one of the fundamental distinctions that are made and that run throughout the teachings is to understand the difference between what they call wholesome and unwholesome, or healthy and unhealthy behaviors, or healthy and unhealthy states of mind, healthy and unhealthy intentions, the actions that we do, either with our body or with speech or with the mind, can be parsed into these two different categories. Now, these categories, healthy and unhealthy, kusala and akusala in Pali, are not meant to be right or wrong or good or bad. It's merely a matter of a more organic way of looking at morality. Something is unhealthy if it causes harm to people, if it causes harm to oneself, if it causes harm to both oneself and others. Something is unhealthy if it obscures the ability to see things clearly, if it leads away from awakened states of mind, if it leads towards greater confusion and suffering for oneself and others. And something is deemed healthy if it's the opposite. Something is wholesome or healthy if it is moving in the direction away from suffering and towards knowledge, if it's working towards the benefit and well-being of people rather than their harmfulness. So it's a very basic distinction that's made early on. What's interesting is in a text when the Buddha speaks in the first person about discovering this distinction and working with it as an important practice for himself before his awakening, he says it something like this. And this is in the middle-length discourses for those of you who are in the study groups. And I think it's discourse number 19. But he says, you know, as I was practicing diligent, ardent, and resolute, there arose an unwholesome thought in my experience. This is before his awakening, by the way. He says that before my awakening, when I was still practicing for enlightenment, an unwholesome thought arose in me. Now, this might be something you can relate to. It happened to me once. Now, the way that the Buddha dealt with this is through several stages. The first thing he says is, and I became aware that this unwholesome thought has arisen in me. In other words, noticing it is the first step. Noticing the internal event of an unwholesome thought arising is the beginning of the practice of integrity. And this is really where the meditation comes in. What meditation is training us to do is put attention toward the inner life. Everything in our biology and everything in our education, everything in our culture, has really oriented us towards the external world. You know, we generally give under attention to the source of our feelings and thoughts and reactions and so forth. And we focus on the effect that they have in the world. Behavior is about changing something out there, doing something out there. Meditation as a form of mental training, and you see this in the foundations of mindfulness teachings, are a matter of turning the attention inward rather than outward. You know, what is going on in my body right now? What sensations are arising and passing away in my knees and my back, you know, and the breathing? You know, yes, the room is out here, but I'm not focusing on the room. When we sit, we even mostly close our eyes so that we can attend to the internal events that are occurring. So learning to notice what's coming up in experience is a huge step. And instead of identifying and projecting everything on the outward, on stage, we're recognizing that it's a dynamic that's happening within us. So the Buddha didn't say, you know, I noticed that it was a bad day because it was raining. He was simply noticing that the thought, I'm making this part up, noticing the fact that I feel resentful about the fact that it's raining, let's say. That's an internal experience. It's got nothing to do with the world out there. So we use mental training to help us be able to notice what's going on in our experience. That's the first step. But the second step is crucial. Because what he said after that, when he noticed something unhealthy or unwholesome arising in his mind, he said, and I understood about that, that it was harmful, that it was unhealthy. And that word understand there is crucial. Because he's basically saying that the practice is not only to notice what's arising in experience. Yes, we open the mind to being with whatever arises. But the next step, what takes that in the direction towards wisdom and is itself a reflection of wisdom, is the understanding of that internal event in terms of its moral quality. Is this a wholesome or an unwholesome thought? Is it a healthy or an unhealthy thought? And being able to understand that it's an unhealthy thought is a reflection of his wisdom. At that point, he was able to see and know it for what it was. And that's where the practice of meditation is taken a step farther towards wisdom. The reason that we develop mindfulness about our inner states is so that we can cultivate the wisdom of understanding that they're transient, that they're ungratifying, that they're selfless. That's the direction that the meditation is leading. But it won't go there by itself without this extra move of understanding, of bringing wisdom to the understanding of the character, the nature of the thoughts that are arising and passing away. Now the third step then is he's saying, okay, an unwholesome thought has arisen in me. I understood that it's unwholesome because it leads towards suffering and away from awakening. And then the third step was, and he decided to abandon it. Deciding to abandon something that's unhealthy, that is also informed by wisdom, but I would say that's enacted wisdom. That's where he is making a decision to alter behavior in some way. So I would go so far as to say, and this might even be the punchline of the day, I really understand sila, or integrity, to be enacted wisdom, to be enacted, embodied understanding. Again, we're used to in our culture making these distinctions. You know, this is what I know with my head, and this is what I do with my heart or my body. You know, I understand things intellectually, but, you know, I'm acting from my gut. You know, we have this distinction. But the Buddha was not thinking in those terms, that kind of separation. And when you understand something to be unhealthy, then the important step of transformation is to recognize that that's something that is to be abandoned, to not be held onto, to not be cultivated. And a lot of his progress along the path from that point forward was being able to make this distinction between what is healthy and what is not healthy, both for himself and as it's enacted through behavior to everyone around them, and to be able to have the strength of insight to be able to abandon something that's clearly unhealthy. Now, a lot of us, a lot of the time, can understand that something isn't good for us or isn't the right thing to do on some level, but we don't necessarily have the ability to transform our behavior around it. But, you know, in the Buddhist tradition, these things are seen to be organic, to grow naturally and gradually and so forth. And moment after moment after moment, we have the opportunity to work with it. Every moment is a new beginning. Every moment is a new set of circumstances. Everything that's arising is passing away, and then other things are arising again. When you get down to the level of lived experience, this distinction between integrity, mental training, and understanding are so intertwined, so interrelated, they're really three aspects of the same phenomenon. Because our experience is thoroughly and profoundly a process. It's something that's unfolding differently every single moment. And at every single moment, we're having glimpses of insight where we understand something beautifully. And the minute we have that glimpse of insight, it slips away. And there are times when we can see our mindfulness and our concentration very clearly, but the next moment it'll be shattered by some stray thought or some unintended sound or whatever. In the same way, we can have all good intentions to behave in some morally virtuous way, and we can actually watch ourselves not be able to accomplish that. You know, everything is moving and shifting and shaping all the time, and this tradition is inviting us to bring this level of attentiveness to the flux of experience itself, to the stream of consciousness, to bring attentiveness to examining in detail not only what is arising and passing away, but the quality of what is arising and passing away, as measured on the scale of what's healthy and unhealthy. Now, it also so happens, and I don't think this is any coincidence, that the word for healthy and unhealthy also means skillful and unskillful. And so this word kusala means someone who is skilled. And you can be skilled in what is good. You can be skilled in the profession. You can be skilled at any number of things. The Buddha is actually inviting us to gain the skill of being a better person, to gain the ability to more and more successfully see what's going on in our experience, understand the nature of what's going on in our experience, and then to have the ability to alter it. And that altering of it really is not going to come from an outward set of principles of morality. You know, we can't take the five precepts, for example, of lay people for living as a kind of, as a precept. You know, I'm going to say in a moment, that's actually a mistranslation. The word precept isn't there at all. That's a Western idea. A precept is something out there that I have to agree with, that I have to enact in some way. What we're going to see is that a precept actually, in indigenous Buddhist language, is more a guideline for applying your understanding to your behavior, and not a simple list of things to do and to not do. So the fourth step in this text, where the Buddha talked about him working with unskillful states or unwholesome states, was first seeing it, understanding it, deciding to abandon it, and then reviewing himself from time to time and checking out. This is like a feedback loop. Well, how did that go? Is it successful? If I'm trying to abandon this resentment I'm feeling to a coworker, let's say, you check in with yourself from time to time. Say, well, how do I feel about that coworker? Do I still harbor that resentment? Am I still holding on to that that thing that they did wrong, that I disagree with or whatever? And if you are still holding on to it, then the work continues. You don't chastise yourself for doing that. Oh, I'm bad, I'm doing this wrong. It's more that, this unwholesome thought is arising again. But now I reiterate my understanding that this is unhealthy for myself, let alone the other person. And I bring to bear on the situation that understanding, such that I may be this time able to change the behavior. Or if not this time, maybe next time, or the time after that, and so forth. So being able to truthfully and honestly check in to the quality of your mind's thoughts and your impulses and intentions and behaviors and so forth is the fourth part of that process. And it's sort of a feedback and review process. Now, here again, though, what is going to give us the ability to see honestly what's going on in our own mind? How can we review and tell ourselves truthfully whether it's abandoned or not abandoned? And here again is where the practices of meditation are so important. For one thing, you're not going to be able to see clearly what's going on in your experience if your mind is clouded by any of the five hindrances. These I'm sure you've heard of and worked with many times. There's simple, five simple aspects of the mind that inhibit or obstruct or hinder our ability to see things truthfully, to see things clearly. So if there's any desire for sensual gratification, if there's any ill will or annoyance or aversion towards somebody or something or some experience, if there's any kind of restlessness or sluggishness or doubt in the mind, those five hindrances, they're going to prevent you from seeing honestly and clearly what's going on in your mind. So by temporarily abandoning those, the whole idea is to be able to see more clearly what's going on. Now, when we look at the details that the sort of theoretical psychology of Buddhism has bequeathed us and explained on how the mind and body works, especially how things go from an impulse to a behavior in our world, in our experience, that gives us a model to work with in understanding better this practice of integrity. So this is the way it works. There is basically a set of causes and effects that we've developed over our lifetimes and that are enacted moment to moment that help us get through our day, that define us as who we are as a person, our personality, our habits, our behaviors, and so forth. We know in Buddhist thought that they talk about the whole mind and body as a process rather than a thing. There is no fixed identity, there's no transcendent soul, there's no hardcore essence of who you are making you behave the way you have to be. They have this beautiful poetic imagery of the mind being like a bubble on a stream, on a river, or an eddy in a stream, some little whirlpool and so forth. And that sounds all very effervescent, but if you're a little leaf caught in that whirlpool, even though that whirlpool is finite and it's not going to exist, as a leaf you're really helpless in the current of that. So it may be that ultimately our personality is just this shifting pattern that's reacting and interacting with the world in all these creative ways. But in that moment, when we're trying to restrain ourselves from some difficult behavior, or we're trying to avoid getting reactive when somebody treats us badly and so forth, we can feel as helpless as that leaf in the current, in the swirl. And so how do we use the understandings that the Buddha is giving us about how this process works to help get past that? Well, they say that really there are three levels of experience that are happening at any given moment. The first is what they call a latent stage. And this more or less corresponds to what we think of as the unconscious, or of our character traits, our habits that we've developed over time. We learn something by consciously attending to it, and then once we learn it, we kind of relegate it into the deeper parts of our mind to be enacted automatically. Like, walking or driving or typing or playing music or whatever. We gradually attend less and less to it consciously, and it becomes an automatic response, an automatic process, an habituation, if you will, a learned behavior, a conditioned response, that sort of thing. Well, the Buddhists recognize that our personality is filled with these, that we have all kinds of automatic programs that are in a latent phase. They're potentials. They're not enacted until they're triggered by some stimulus. Somebody says something and it brings out the reflex to defend ourselves, to attack someone, to say something unhealthy or unwholesome, or strike out, lash out at someone, for example. And these latent tendencies have been learned through activities and then stored, and somehow they don't describe material how it's stored, in our psyche. Then as we're going through experiences and some stimulus occurs, then those are evoked, they're provoked in various ways. And when they come out, they surge out. And this sort of surging stage of behavior is, what we call action. You know, when we're saying things, when we're doing things, when we're even thinking things, we often don't have a lot of conscious control over what we're thinking, saying, or doing. You may have noticed that. That this it's called a surging stage because by the time this automatic reflex has been enacted, it's out of your conscious control. You're getting angry at somebody and insulting them before you're even aware that you're doing it much of the time. And that's a gross example, but there are subtle examples of behaviors coming out without our really thinking of it. Now, in between this sort of vast reservoir of potential responses, and then the actual one that's enacted in any given moment and surging into our behavior, there's a very thin layer, this third piece, called the arising or the presenting stage of experience. This is where we actually can have the ability to see what's coming up. We can watch thoughts, for example, or actions in the arising phase as it moves from latent to surging. Let's take a very simple example from your meditation experience. Walking meditation. In walking meditation, you're trying to bring attention, conscious awareness, to the act of walking. Now, walking, the mechanisms for walking are basically a set of latent dispositions. You learned how to walk, you know, when you were 1 year old or 2 years old. You've been learning all along. It's natural. It's automatic. We don't think about it. And most of the time when we're doing something else and we manage to walk down the sidewalk without, you know, stumbling or bumping into anybody, it's because it's in a surging stage. We've gone from automatic walking to actual walking while we're not paying attention to any of it because we're thinking about something else. While we're in a conversation or we're listening to music or whatever. So much of what we do, some would even say all of what we do, but much of what we do is going from an invisible stage below the threshold of awareness to an invisible stage enacted in the world behaviorally and bypassing entirely that stage where it can be seen as it occurs. So mindfulness meditation has a lot to do with training ourselves to bring attention to what's about to happen, or what's just beginning to happen, or, you know, we're going to be lifting, moving, and placing the foot, whether we pay attention to it or not. But let's see if we can notice the incident, the very specific, nuanced, individual incident of lifting the foot at that moment, of moving it at that moment, of placing it at that moment. In that way, we're kind of taking this very thin piece of the presenting stage of behavior and widening it so that we can see more and more of what had been automatic behavior, but now we see it in terms of with present moment awareness, with mindfulness. The same thing, of course, is happening with breathing. You know how to breathe without paying attention. We train ourselves to pay attention to the breathing so that we notice the breath as it's happening. Now, in whatever humble ways, that training of the mind is helping us access something that content-wise we don't need to access. You know, it's not about, you know, it's important that you know that you're breathing, because it's not. What's important is the quality of mind that is able to recognize what's happening as it's happening. And then when we can develop that in such mundane circumstances as walking and breathing, maybe we can bring that out into other aspects of our behavior. So now when we're, you know, driving in the car, or when we're at work and some colleague or other driver does something, you know, that impinges upon our, you know, identity in some important way, we might still see them, you know, see the reactivity occurring. It might still just come out in a rude word or an angry gesture or a pernicious thought. But maybe this time we'll be able to see it happening instead of just enacting it without knowledge whatsoever. This is using mental training to bring attention to the process by which behaviors are moving from this latent into the surging stage. And so mindful training and mindfulness allows us to notice more and more and more of what's happening in our experience. And that's, remember, that first stage in what the Buddha was talking about. I notice that an unwholesome thought has arisen. So instead of just, you know, punching the guy out, you notice that you feel like punching the guy out. That's a huge step. Because now instead of something automatically getting enacted, you're going to notice that you have the intention to enact it. You're going to notice that you have the impulse to enact it. You're going to notice that before it happens, that you feel you want to do something. Now, once you've accessed that, then you can bring to bear this part of wisdom, this deeper part that understands that that's an unhealthy thing to do, understands that that's inappropriate, understands that that's going to cause more harm than good. And so you've used the mindfulness to gain access, once again, to what is otherwise an automatic process. Now, generally in our language, when we say that you bring control or intervention to something that you weren't able to control before, we call that freedom. It's actually giving us a little piece of freedom. The freedom to either go with that impulse or not, or to abandon it. In some cases, if you reflect and say, well, okay, it's not the most healthy thing to do, but, you know, it's not that bad either, so you go ahead and do it. In another circumstance, you might understand that it's really a very unhealthy thing to do, and so you abstain, you hold back. But you're only going to be able to hold back from that in direct proportion to how deeply and fully you understand its quality, its impact, its fundamental integrity. Now, going back to this three-part model of integrity and mental development and wisdom, we can see that really what's the when we talk about morality generally, when we talk about the practice of integrity, it's largely about bringing to bear certain controls or constraints on our activities, on our behavior. So, you know, I'm going to not do this, this, and this, and I am going to do that, that, and that, one of which is unwholesome, the other is wholesome. And we understand meditation to be strengthening the mind's ability to focus on what's happening and see ever more clearly what's happening. But the practice of wisdom is actually working on the latent stage. What wisdom is doing, ultimately, is transforming the landscape of our unconscious. It's transforming those aspects of our behavior that are otherwise unseen, transforming them in the direction towards more healthiness, more wholesomeness. And that's the part that, you know, we often overlook. It doesn't seem too exciting because we don't get conscious, immediate awareness of what's happening. But it starts slowly to make a difference in the nature of our character. As we gain more and more wisdom, more and more understanding of what's wholesome and unwholesome, as with every episode we're able to abandon what's unwholesome and develop what's wholesome, we are actually changing our character. We're changing the source out of which these impulses arise. When the Buddha talked about wisdom, and he talked about a definition even of right view, one of the components of wisdom, and this is in the ninth discourse, I think, on right view in the Middle Length Discourses, he says, well, the practice of integrity has to do with understanding what is wholesome and unwholesome, and understanding that hurting living beings is unwholesome, understanding that taking what's not given is unwholesome, understanding that misbehaving sexually is unwholesome. And then four kinds of speech, understanding that false speech and abusive speech and frivolous speech and harmful speech are all unwholesome. And then understanding the wantingness, the covetousness of the mind to be unwholesome, understanding the ill will or the aversion, the opposite of that, which is trying to beat off things, is unwholesome. And finally, understanding about the nature of views themselves. But not only does he say that the practice of integrity is the understanding of these things to be unwholesome, but he then goes on to say it also involves understanding the roots of the unwholesome, why those things are harmful, and what their source is. The source of all unwholesome behaviors, the Buddha says, is in the fundamental roots of greed, hatred, and delusion. We have, as part of our human nature, these three rudimentary tendencies. And they're probably instinctual, and they're probably habitual, and they're probably there for good reason in some evolutionary way. But they're doing us a lot of harm. The greed is the attachment to things, the wanting things to be a certain way, the striving for gratification at all times, this sort of acquisitiveness, this kind of control that's wanting to reach out and get what gratifies you, and so forth. Hatred is the opposite of that. It's not wanting to deal with things, wanting to repress them, to kill them, to make them go away, to avoid them, to pretend they're not there. Anything that is distressing to us, anything that's unpleasant, anything that causes pain, we want to block it out somehow. Those two fundamental impulses are what give rise to hurting people, to lying to people. They give rise to various forms of unwholesome speech. And then the third component, the third source of unwholesomeness, is a delusion, just not understanding things that well. Not understanding the interrelationship between things. Not understanding the changeable nature of it all. Not understanding how the things that we think are going to gratify us actually won't always gratify us. And of course, understanding the selflessness, not only of objects out there, but of our own psyche. So it's by not understanding, in these fundamental ways that we misconstrue things. So the practice of integrity has to do with understanding the nature of ourselves. Those parts of ourselves that are unseen, those parts out of which erupt these impulses to do harm, to control, to gratify. There's nothing wrong with them. It's not that they're evil. It's not that they're bad. It's not that they're wrong. It's just that they cause us suffering. And they cause suffering to the people around us. That's why we're working on transforming. So, how do we address then the conventional practices of morality, of integrity, from this more process-based, wisdom-oriented perspective? Well, let's take as a simple example, the five precepts, so-called. The five precepts, as I'm sure you all know, is not to take life, not to steal, not to misbehave sexually, not to misspeak in various ways, and not to misuse intoxicants of various kinds. Now, we can look at that as a list of do's and don'ts. We can look at it as some sort of external covenant that we either agree to or not. We can come up with some sort of definition of all of those things, and then we judge ourselves against that law, so to speak. And if we break the law by, breaking one of the precepts, then we, feel bad about ourselves. We feel guilt, we feel shame, we feel remorse, we feel like a failure, we feel like we hate ourselves for breaking the law, so to speak, that we set up for ourselves. That's the way we're trained to relate to things. A precept is something laid down by a judge that says you're not allowed to do this. And if you do, you'll be punished. And if you don't, you'll be rewarded. But it's not like that at all. For every one of these five precepts, there's really no fixed definition. The terrain of moral activity, of acting with integrity in this world, is constantly shifting and changing. There is no clear definition in the text or anywhere about what exactly taking life means. How can anyone live in this world without doing some sort of harm? All life is built upon the taking of other lives, you know? We can, let's say, at least understand that we're not going to kill anybody on purpose, you know? And that's good. That's, you know, not harming living beings. And we're not going to, you know, deliberately torture furry little animals, you know? We can abstain from that, maybe. Maybe some of us will even decide to be vegetarians so that we're not participating in the whole complex of assailing animals and so forth. But, you know, some might even push that boundary farther and become vegans. Or, you know, but sooner or later, you're going to hit a point where you're still doing harm. You're still killing. You can't drive your car without hitting insects on the windshield. You can't walk down the street or through the woods without stepping on an ant from time to time. You cannot, you know, eat a vegetable that hasn't been, you know, somewhere along the line, some harm was done to the insects that were threatening the vegetables. Hopefully in organic and not inorganic ways, but still. You know, part of the first noble truth of dukkha, of the unsatisfactoriness of the human condition, is that the entire system is built upon death and destruction. It's built upon harming others. You cannot opt out of that just by, you know, curtailing certain behaviors. So where that not harming or not killing really falls in any moment's experience is going to be determined by your own level of understanding, your own level of wisdom. And at one stage of your life, it might be at one point. At another stage, it might be somewhere else. You can make progress or fall back on that front. For some people, not killing might mean, you know, one thing. For someone else, it might mean something else. No one is really in a position to judge the other and say, well, you're not doing it well enough, I am, and so forth. The same is true for all the other precepts. You know, what's considered a false speech? You know, I mean, an outright lie under oath in court for your own personal gain, that's an obvious one. But what about, you know, kind comments to people to make them feel better, or things you might say to a child to console them, you know? And feel safe, you know, little ways that speech is very, very nuanced, you know, are about how you, in everyday circumstances, define right speech. Because truth is not some external standard that it's either met or not met. Again, it's an internal, organic thing changing moment to moment to moment. We are being called upon in this tradition to manifest and exercise our wisdom at every moment's experience, at every opportunity. The same thing with all the other precepts. It's all a moving target. And so within that moving target, I mean, our breath is constantly changing, our bodies are constantly changing, our minds are constantly changing, our understanding is constantly changing. How we are able to meet each moment's challenge is constantly changing. On some days, with a good mood, we feel strong, we feel righteous, we're going to do the right thing, you know. 2 days later, it could be a very different story, you know. We're not proud always of how we act. We're not judging ourselves from the outside. What we're being invited to do, challenged to do, and inspired to do is every single moment bring as much awareness to what's actually going on in the internal situation as we possibly can. That's challenging enough. We're also being challenged, however, to bring as much understanding to what we're seeing as we possibly can. And that understanding itself is moving and growing and changing. It's making progress and backsliding. It's gradually our wisdom will grow and increase as our integrity grows and increases, and vice versa. And both are going to be able to grow and increase to the extent that we're able to bring clear awareness to what we're doing. So all three of these are constantly working together and reinforcing one another. And this tendency that we have to separate them and stratify them and put them in hierarchies and aspire to them and so forth is It's not as helpful a way of approaching the subject as I think the Buddha was offering us. Really, he was encouraging us to see it all as a moving organic whole and to bring as much wisdom as you can to every moment at all times. Now, I'll end with just bringing your attention to the five duties or responsibilities of a householder. I suspect we're all householders here, mostly householders. And the Buddha did have very specific teachings for householders. And some of them we're used to, and some of them might be surprising. There's simply five. Firstly, have faith. Have confidence. Faith not in the Western sense of accepting some creed, but faith just in the sense of being willing to listen when people are speaking about the Dharma, being willing to try it out in your own experience, being willing to learn from your experience, having a certain amount of confidence, go into each moment's experience, to each day's encounter, each interpersonal relationship, with a sense of dignity, a sense of strength, a sense of confidence. This word sadha in Pali, I think, is better translated confidence than faith. Again, faith comes as a Western word with a lot of accoutrements that don't necessarily fit the Buddhist context. So it's about, you know, go at your life with some sense of stability and strength and confidence. The second duty or responsibility of the householder is integrity. Sila. You know, try to understand as best you can what's wholesome and what's unwholesome. Try to enact as best you can in any given situation the wholesome, and try to abandon the unwholesome. You know, the basic practice of the four great efforts. You know, a wholesome thought can either be manifest or unmanifest. If it's unmanifest, see what you can do to bring wholesomeness into your life by the choices you make of various kinds. And when wholesomeness is there, see what you can do to develop it, to guard it, to protect it, to enhance it, and so forth. And the unwholesome stuff that hasn't come up yet, see what you can do to dissuade it from arising. Don't put yourself in a situation where you know the temptation is going to be there to misbehave, if you can help it. And when something unwholesome has come up, see it for what it is, and don't continue to hold on to it, but abandon it. So there's four basic approaches to working with wholesome and unwholesome is one of the duties of the householder. The third one is an untranslatable word. It's chaga in Pali, and it's translated sometimes as renunciation and sometimes as generosity. And maybe that's an intentional ambiguity, that where one leaves off and the other begins isn't always clear. Renunciation, not in the sense of, you know, eat one meal a day and wear one set of robes and shave your head every day and spend most of the day in meditation like the monastics do. That's obviously not the kind of renunciation he's prescribing for lay people who have an obligation to live in the world with duties and family and profession and so forth. But maybe it's a word that can be vitalized today in a new way. Maybe it has something to do with consumerism. Maybe something to do with not needing to gratify yourself to the full extent possible all the time. But something you could do, but you don't have to, so you don't. You renounce it. Or the generosity, too. Generosity is your giving over ownership of something. You know, this is mine and I'm not going to share it with anybody. Generosity is when you share it with somebody. And it's not necessarily, you know, specific about, you know, making donations or that sort of thing. I mean, the gift of generosity, you know, we give safety to children. We give health to the elderly. Various ways that lay people, because they're the ones that really run the economy and the administration of the world and so forth, to just bring an attitude of generosity to those in need, to those who are deserving of, for those who are doing good work in the world. Try to use your resources as a layperson, whether they be great or small, to encourage what's wholesome and skillful in this world, both the very personal world and the broader world, and to discourage and dissuade those things that are unwholesome. So, you know, there are ways in which we distribute our earnings and that have an impact on the kind of world that gets nurtured and inhibited by those distributions. I think that's simply what it's referring to. This fourth duty or obligation or responsibility for a householder, believe it or not, is study. Investigate. And I take the word study very broadly. The study center in Barrie is organized around the fundamental idea that there's really no distinction between study and practice. So study can mean, you know, read the Dharma, listen to talks, you know, come to Mark's classes, you know, try to understand what the Buddha was saying and what other people understand him to be saying, and try to, understand the study in that sense. But it also means study your experience. Study cause and effect as you see it in your life. Study the micro-processing of your mind as it responds to something gratifying or threatening. Study your experience, in other words. The text is one ground of study, but the body and mind is another ground of study. And to investigate, to explore, to examine, to bring a nuanced understanding to what's going on is an important duty for the householder. And the fifth and final one is wisdom. This clearly and distinctly says wisdom is not something that's just the provenance of the monk or the nun or the meditator or the arhat or the Buddha. Wisdom is something that a householder can and should cultivate at all times in their lives. It's a worthy goal. It's a worthy responsibility. It's a duty, even, to try to bring as much understanding of yourselves, of the world around you, of the teachings, of the practice, into anything and everything you do throughout your lives. And that's something that's been encouraged very specifically by the Buddha. Okay, well, I better end there. It's about 2:30. And feel free to ask any questions or make any comments that you like. If anybody needs to leave, that's probably okay too, or stretch. Feel free. Yes?
I wonder, puzzled by the word integrity doesn't appear in the translations of some of the texts. And one of the things that occurs to me is that in the Western tradition, our connotations of integrity are around kind of an authenticity of self, to that own self be true. And I just wondered if integrity is kind of too much about having a personalized sense of self and being authentic with that. That's one reason why it's been kind of anathema to the translation.
Yeah, it may well be. I mean, with all these technical words, there aren't that many choices. You know, there's only 3 or 4 or 5 equivalents that we could bring to a word like that. Everyone has got advantages and drawbacks. Everyone's got pros and cons, each of the words that we choose. I think it's true that, you know, integrity will bring baggage with it too, and especially that phrase, be true to yourself. I mean, Buddhism both sees things that way and doesn't see things that way. I mean, obviously not the self part, literally. But there's still that feeling tone. You know, one of the things that the Buddhists say are part of our human nature is a sense of conscience, and both a personal conscience and a social conscience. They say that that's inborn, it's natural, and it's always operative in any wholesome mind moment. And it's always bypassed or inoperative in any unwholesome mind moment. So just the sense of, you know what's the right thing to do, you know, in yourself, it's not the existential self, but it's this. Reflexively, we can use that word. If you deeply know and have an intuition that what you're doing is wrong, listen to that voice. You know, that's a form of integrity. But I've only recently started using this word integrity for sila, and I'm not entirely sure of all the ramifications, and it may be that there are some aspects of it that don't work that well. But I think the sense of knowing for yourself what's wholesome and unwholesome is what it brings that I like about it. Yes?
Integrity is something that I think a lot about lately, particularly kind of given the state of the world and world leaders, all of those things, wondering if people have integrity. It's a word that I really like a lot. And as I was listening to you talk, the other thing that came to mind was described to me something like beware of false prophets. And so to me, that makes me think about integrity again. You know, it's really, I think, meaty, you know, because there's so much bound up in it, but it really makes me curious, like, where is the world integrity?
Yeah. Well, you know, a similar word in English is nobility. You know, if somebody has a noble character, they've got great integrity. And we recognize that quality in people when we see it in the world, and we admire it, and it gives us trust and a sense of safety. If we know that the person in charge has got integrity, it's a very different feeling than when we know that they're not.
But when I hear nobility, then it makes me think about people that are higher up looking down on somebody else, like, you know, the Church of England or something.
Yeah, and that's, again, part of it. You know, the word in Buddhism, you know, it's the noble truths, the noble path, the noble ones, you know. The Buddha was a noble one. Become a noble one. What they mean is become someone with sufficient integrity that you've got a highly developed sense of wisdom, and vice versa. And so it's from the ancient text, it's coming sort of from the inside out. Nobility is not something you're born to. It's something you enact. And he says this all the time in his in ancient texts against the Brahmins. You know, the Brahmins are always saying, well, we were born in this special ethnic and socioeconomic class, and so we're better than you. And he kept saying, no, a person's worth comes from their internal nobility, their internal sense of integrity. And that's how I'm trying to use the word.
Mm-hmm. I think that it makes a lot of sense. I think that it can be really something to ponder, kind of given the state of the world.
We certainly need more of it, whatever it is. Yes?
So in trying to practice integrity, I'm trying to use an example of kind of being non-threatening or non-personal, but saying, you know, how we want to be driving down the road, someone cuts you off, and you want to have integrity about that, and your first reaction is, let's say your first reaction is to flip them off, you know, you're just really mad, and then you say, wow, you know, that wasn't that skillful, and the next time I don't want to do that, and well, it hasn't yet been performed yet. And then, you know, over time, maybe for like a month or two or longer, then you kind of, you see your steering wheel, so you don't do anything.
Yeah.
You still have the anger, and you're so riled up. And I guess it would help me if you could take a few classes, like we, because there's something I'm really struggling with, where you know it's not wholesome, it's so ingrained, it's so reactive, it's so deeply connected from the whole life. And I'd love to get rid of it, and it fills the heart where I just see it's causing me suffering, I see it's causing other people suffering, but I just can't, I don't know, can you just give more of an example, just, okay, here's day one, and then...
Well, yes. As a matter of fact, this particular example I'm very familiar with, coming from the Boston area. It's even called the Boston Salute. So, okay, so here you are, minding your own business, driving along, and part of the sense of why we feel insulted when somebody cuts us off is because we extend our sense of ownership. You know, this is my space. This is my right of way, you know. And so the stronger that is, the more easily we'll be provoked with aversion or hatred or whatever to this person. So one strategy the Buddhists always suggest is relate to things as not me, not mine, not myself. And so then it says, you know, if you're, like, we're getting off the plane today, you know, if everybody tried to get off the plane at the all at the same time, it wouldn't work. There's an understanding that the front row is empty out first, and then the next rows, and the next row. And when you see somebody five rows ahead of you step out into the aisle, it doesn't bother you. That's not my space yet. When somebody right in front of you steps out, you've defined it as my space. I have the right of way. And so, you know, that's one strategy. The other thing, as you suggest, is a gradual transformation. You know, the first, you flip them off and you're not even aware you're doing it. The next step is you do it and you're aware that you're doing it. And you might even participate with gusto in doing it. This is mindfulness of the fact that you're doing it. But you see, as your understanding evolves and you get to understand more and more that not only is it a not nice thing to do to that person, but it's not healthy for yourself. Because now for the next 5 minutes, you're going to spend your life grinding your teeth thinking harmful thoughts about that guy. That person's probably, you know, listening to the radio and figuring out what they're going to do today. They have absolutely no knowledge of what you're doing. And so you're not making a difference to their behavior. All you're doing is polluting your morning with your own toxins, so to speak. And so you get to understand that after a while. And then, you know, when you feel the impulse to do it, you might do it anyway, and then eventually you feel the impulse and you say, no, I now have a little bit of freedom to decide. Do I want to do this or not? In some cases, you might decide to go through with it. Other cases, you might decide, well, you know, maybe I don't have to do that. So this sort of gradual stepping down, and you might get to the point where, you know, when somebody cuts you off, you just, you know, may you be happy. Back on the way. But the other thing is understanding of interdependence, you know. When you recognize that that person, when you think, well, that person's just a jerk, and that's why they're doing this, and so they deserve this gesture on my part. But, you know, when you understand maybe in that particular case, they were cut off by somebody in the other lane, and they were, you know, swerving to get out of the way to protect some child in the back, you know. Or maybe they are in this terrible marriage and had this rotten morning, and so they're in a rotten mood, and they can't help but be mean to people. You begin to feel compassion for that person being in that situation. It's not necessarily their fault. They're merely expressing their state of wisdom, their state of quality of their mind in that moment, which may be very disrespectful of other people's rights and spaces and so forth. But maybe that's coming from a specific set of reasons that you don't fully understand. But as you get in the habit of responding to people with loving kindness and understanding and caring about the reasons why things are the way they are, and you gradually move away from, I need to express this emotion, or that person, you know, must be a certifiable jerk. You know, everything dissolves and gets more interrelated and more interdependent. So between, you know, choosing what's healthy for yourself and seeing the interrelatedness of it and gradually stepping down the voltage of that instinct, you know, you can change. But you have to have the patience and the compassion to yourself to allow that change to be gradual. Nothing in nature happens very quickly. It all happens gradually. And you are growing yourself into a different kind of person. You're not cutting anything off or forcing it into some mold. And if you take that approach, it's more gradual, but it's more effective. Yes?
Metaphors, when you step back, you might also find out that you're the person that's in the wrong lane.
Yeah. The Taoists have this wonderful story about, you know, a boat coming down in the fog and this guy's really mad. I've got the right of way, get out of there. But then you find the boat is empty. There's nobody to blame. If there's nobody to blame, you just feel foolish. Well, that person is a non-self, you know. There isn't really anybody there to blame. There's a set of causes and conditions that are making them act that way. That's a good point. Yes.
Yes, hi. I've been struggling with a couple of couple years ago, I made a vow to myself to not engage in gossip, which was great, love it. So I have some periods with it. But for the most part, I found that if I do gossip, it was a very bitter taste in my mouth, and I feel so much cleaner and healthier not doing it. What I'm struggling with is, and it's not here because I'm new to this community, so it's not these people. Why I'm here so much. Intellectually, I'm in the belief system that we're all together, but then I'm feeling this separately. And it's not like I'm feeling left out, because these people are still including me in their circle, but yet I step back from this engagement. So it's a very subtle feeling that I feel separate from their world. Do you have any ideas on how to deal with this?
Well, first I would say that the Buddhist teaching on right speech is itself very subtle. I mean, there's this false speech, there's abusive speech, there's malignant speech, and then there's... they don't actually call it gossip, they call it frivolous speech. Now, the one that I find the most important is really the divisive speech. You know, one form of speech that the Buddha is condemning is putting one group against another. And so trying to get these people to think badly of those people, and trying to get those people to think badly of those people, speech that inclines towards separation. And he said, right speech tries to reconcile groups and bring them together and heal and so forth. So a lot of what we call gossip, the harmfulness comes from the divisiveness. It's not just that it's frivolous. Did you know so-and-so had such and such a dress yesterday? I mean, that's not the most meaningful thing to say, but it's not really, you know, doing that much harm. But if the gossip is malicious in some way, where people are really trying to hurt one another, then maybe that's the part that needs to be addressed.
A lot of us mentoring, especially in programs, and a lot of that. So we've seen a lot of that.
Because something, one thing we overlook in many communities, gossip is a form of social cohesion. Mm-hmm. You know, talking to one another about others is most of what many people do much of the time, you know? And again, in and of itself, it's not bad. It's, again, the question is, with what quality of mind is one engaging in this discussion? And if they're engaging in a way that's just maybe shallow and frivolous, that's not nearly as bad as malicious and harmful. Like if somebody's really trying to gather everybody to do something hurtful to this person, then your feeling of separation is justified. Because you're trying to not generate those unwholesome states of mind. And if it really, if it crosses over a certain line, you know, you really need to say something to somebody and say, do you realize the harm that you're causing by this? You know, the kind of bullying that goes on and the kind of, you know, scapegoating and so forth can get incredibly cruel in many, many communities. That's the part we want to focus on. And so the classical way the Buddhists would say it is, you know, it's okay and even encouraged to separate yourself from unwholesome things and align yourself with wholesome things. And if that means separating from a certain sub-community at your workplace to allow you to realign with a different sub-community, that could turn out to be a very good thing. But if it's a matter of trying to maintain some sense of inclusiveness in the group, maybe you can use your influence from the inside to steer that away from actual maliciousness and into something less harmful.
Right. If there's one person attacking, I'll try to, well, kind of like a friend, do it. You know, there could be, try to put the perspective from that person that's not there, and try to speak for that person, not there to stand up for themselves and say, possibly this is what's happening.
Yeah, or speak to the person doing it and say, you know, what are you so insecure about that you've got to make other people, put other people down? You know, why does that make you feel better?
Yeah.
special offer that what came up in me was that when people refrain from harmful speech, it, yes, it's true that it may pull them out and put them in a different relationship to the group and it can feel separate, but it might also be perceived gradually by the group as that I'm making things more safe, that what you're doing is actually a gift to the community.
Yeah.
And you don't need, life is good. So you've got that aspect to deal with and to practice with, this feeling that I have of isolation. But at the same time, if I can hang in there, I think I'm going to find some allies, or even if I never do, there's a way that I'm sort of like that. Mother would say, it's the example I'm saying. That allows the whole community to function.
Yeah. And we're all setting examples all the time.
I have a question about the latent tendencies you're talking about. You said something about how wisdom allows us to transform the landscape of our latent tendency or something like that. You're talking about a Western spirit, right?
Yes.
And I'm reading his book, and he talks about how those latent tendencies, like, you never actually transform or get rid of all that. He talks about it, you don't really are ever really released from them, but more you have a different relationship with them, and you learn how to relate to them in a new way. But they're always sort of there. And so it's a little bit confusing, because on the one hand, you know, Western psychology, you talk about how we have this, Freud talks about the id, like there's a sort of reservoir of greed and anger that we have to kind of uncover and unpack to get rid of, to understand. But in Buddhism, they talk about there's momentum and habit energy, but it's not like a reservoir of greed in us. It's just things are triggered and they come up and then you have to deal with them at that moment. There's not you can kind of dig under and get to the core, because there is no core, right? So, like, when I notice I'm very reactive with my kids, my 3-year-old likes to hit. I get very, I grab, the bat from his hand, and I get very angry sometimes. And I'm like, oh, where's that coming from? I'm so reactive. It's not like I can meditate, like, okay, this is a latent tendency, reactivity. You can't be on this gross level trying to uncover this latent tendency, this strategy, right? Because it seems like it's kind of...
Well, there's two perspectives on that. One is sort of the classic Buddhist perspective, and the other is you and me trying to get by in this world as households. Okay. The classic perspective actually is different from the Western psychological view. It says that these underlying tendencies of greed, hatred, and delusion can be completely and utterly overcome, abandoned, destroyed, dried up. The image they use is drying up of a stream. It's not like you beat them down and kill them or stuff them in a cave or any of that. That's not going to work because that's using aversion toward them. You know, if anger comes up and you hate the anger, you're just making it stronger if you've acted out and so forth. But they do say that every time you become aware of the anger and notice it as anger and you become mindful of the anger instead of being angry, you are transforming it slightly. You are making it incrementally less powerful. And that eventually, the very definition of nirvana in the classical text is the complete drying up of greed, hatred, and delusion. And, for us lay people living in the world, I don't think that's likely. And so we are more in the situation is every time it comes up, how do we, cut it off? It's like grass growing, it's going to keep coming up and keep mowing the lawn. But ultimately, the arhat has pulled the root out, and so it doesn't come up anymore. Now, maybe in the bigger picture, we can't do that with the most fundamental drives of greed, hatred, and delusion. But there are all kinds of little eddies in our individual rivers that we can transform. I mean, if somebody has a persistent issue with anger management or a persistent issue with guilt or shame or with, this, that, or the other thing, you know, there are ways in which it can be attenuated gradually over time, either through professional psychological help of various kinds or through Dharma practice and meditation of various kinds that will bring about more longer-lasting transformations. So I understand where he and others of that school are coming from. You know, psychologists take for granted that everybody's screwed up. Sorry. Are we off the record yet? And then everything organizes around that. But Buddhists start from the assumption that people can be fully and completely healed of the toxins. They're like pollutants. That well can be capped eventually. The reservoir of oil will no longer come up. It might be another few centuries, but post-peak oil. But sooner or later, all the petroleum is going to be gone. You know, it's a different model, but they do hold out that promise. Anything else? We've got 3 whole minutes.
I was going to ask the connection to this. You mentioned the thing about it bringing the attention and the awareness to a situation actually does gradually transform. Is there a connection to the, like, theoretical or quantum physics with that? Like Heisenberg's principle of, like, you know, entanglement, where if you're doing an experiment, you know, you're automatically affecting its result by watching or by doing.
I'm not inclined to make that connection. I think that that's an error of scale. You know, trying to get microphysics and psychology aligned. I mean, many people do. I'm not in that school. But there is a sense in which, you know, it's not so much the attention itself is transformative. It's that the quality of the attention is transformative. And this is a subtle point, and it has a lot to do with the controversies these days on how to define mindfulness. You know, Buddhists are very sophisticated about this. You can be attentive to something, and you're not necessarily transforming it. You're just noticing, oh, look at what a jerk I am, you know. Here I am being a jerk again. You could go your whole life noticing that, you know. What I'm trying to argue for here is understanding that, you know, that's not such a good thing. It doesn't have to be like that, and there are ways that it can change. And that's the part, it's awareness with understanding that's transformative. And that's a little bit more subtle. But see, any given moment of consciousness, there's going to be the object of the awareness and there's going to be the attitude with which you're aware of it. And if what you see is, you know, your son's stick, and the attitude you have is one of anger, not necessarily to him, but to the whole violence and represented by the stick, then you're kind of lost. You're caught by the anger. And it doesn't matter what the object is. I mean, you could see Saint Teresa, and because you're angry, you're going to project that anger onto her, you know. That's just something you're carrying with you. It's like a fire hose just streaming out anger on anything that gets in your path. You know what I'm talking about, right? And same thing with all the other emotions. Every one of them is like that. What's important is transforming the way you're feeling about the object. And then, you know, if the anger becomes an object of attention, and now you become interested in that as an object, then the interest in it is the mindfulness. It's the attitude of mind that is intrigued by, curious about, and wanting to investigate what's going on here. And you can't be angry and mindful at the same time. If you're angry, you're not mindful. And if you're mindful, you're not angry. So you're really trying to swap the two. And you have to do it usually by a sleight of hand. Usually, you know, all right, I'm really, really angry. At who? At everybody, at everything. Well, how does that feel in the body? Oh, okay, let's do some mindfulness of the body now. I feel my heart pumping. I feel my muscles tightening. I feel my breathing being heavy. And then, you know, a few moments downstream, suddenly you catch yourself. I'm really interested in the nuances of what my body is doing. I've forgotten the anger, you know. And then you've shifted and you've broken the cycle. And the same thing for cutting some, you know, getting cut off in traffic, you know. You change the focus to from that jerk to how am I feeling about this? And then that the interest that will naturally develop around the internal states will turn the corner, and the anger will then be dissipated. Now, it's not going to be cured forever. It's going to come up again later. But if you suppress it, it's just going to get worse. If you act it out, it's going to get worse. The middle ground is to see it, understand it, abandon it, and set up for the next mind moment, you know, which could be the anger again. But every time you sort of jujitsu'd it, you know, it's become a little bit weaker. And that part of you that is striving for nobility and integrity and wisdom gets a little stronger. And incrementally, the whole tide changes. Okay, I think we're out of time.
Thanks so much, Andy.
Thank you all.
And if people would like to support Andy's livelihood, most of you know we have a donation goal out in the lobby. When we have visiting teachers like Andy, the contributions that are left get shared with the teacher, the guest teacher, and some stay with the center. And if you want to study with Andy, one way you can do that is purchase his new book, published by Wisdom, Unlimiting Mind, the Radically Experiential Psychology of Buddhism. I think on Amazon, Doug McGill's reviews there, I read it was really good. A lot of you know Doug. That book's available. And also, Andy, for a long time, has been the editor of Insight Journal, a wonderful twice-a-year journal that is published by the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies, where Andy works. And you can get this just by contacting the center. They got lucky and got dharma.org as their website, and you can, subscribe on the website. Is that correct?
Yeah, and it's free. Subscribe simply means that you tell us where to send it.
So it's wonderful. And a lot of the people who teach at the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies from time to time have articles in the journal. And so you get a real diverse sort of perspective on this tradition. So thanks so much, Andy.
My pleasure.
Thanks for coming, everyone.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.